Hi, you're listening to What's the Schemata, a schema therapy podcast for therapists. With ISST accredited schema therapy supervisors and trainers, Chris Hayes and Rob Brockman. For more information on schema therapy, visit our website, schematherapytraining.com.
Okay, welcome everyone to this episode 45 of What's the Schemata. And I'm here with Chris Hayes. And we've just spent a week together at our semi sort of yearly retreat over in Bali. And we had three wonderful presenters over there. And yeah, we've just been sort of bouncing reflections on some of the teachings and learnings and some of the ideas, but also over the last sort of 12 months, bouncing ideas off each other. How are you going, Chris?
I'm back in my schema bunker. Deep underground.
Perth bunker. What does your schema bunker look like?
It's deep. It's dark. I'm learning things, I think. But yeah, it's not out in the sunshine. So, yeah.
Well, it's just nice. It was nice to maybe get a chance, I guess with any workshop, get a chance to sit back and reflect on your practice and new ideas that are coming up, old ideas that are more nuanced. Yeah. So our theme for today, we just wanted to make some time to talk about, well, key learnings maybe over the 2024 and the last 12 months. Some of that will be some new ideas we've run into by way of some of the workshops we've been to. And some of these ideas might be maybe a bit more of a nuance or a deeper dive into some of the more established techniques and ideas in schema. So you up for it?
Yeah. I mean, yeah. So I guess we all have those sort of moments where we, you know, you read the same literature. You and me do a lot of workshops. So, you know, just pick up little bits, little shiny little things that go, oh, wow, that's good. I like that. So I guess that's the point today, isn't it?
Totally, yeah. And also getting a chance to learn from other trainers and like sitting for a couple of days with an experienced trainer and clinician and having different ideas. And so that's been really cool. But I think there's enough there for a really pretty solid episode. So
I reckon we dedicate this episode to those that are doing exercise while listening to us. I spoke to a supervisee who says he goes to the gym and he's listening to us in the gym.
Yes.
So
Those doing chores, mowing the lawn or doing the dishes while listening to Schemata. We're glad that it can be a kind of crutch in that way. So, look, one other thing, way of looking at today's episode is when you get into a therapy, there can be a sort of urge or a search for freshness. You know, we want to stay fresh. You know, where's, you know, the nuance? Where's the edge?
It's so clean.
Yeah. So this is our attempt at you know, fresh ideas in schema. Yeah. So what do you got for us? Why don't you go first and then I'll hit you with some stuff that I've been thinking about.
Okay. Well, something I've been playing around for a bit myself, and I've been talking with a couple of supervisees in around this space. It's a very simple idea, but you often get dialogues with modes and you have a dialogue with the punitive critic or the, you know, the coping modes, but over the last, you know, couple of years, last five years or so, there's been a lot more development in healthy adult mode, okay, and this idea of just rather than it just coming out of the ground and, you know, you're working with all these modes and the therapist is doing a lot of work, you know, it's using the strength of the client to respond to things. And one missing dialogue, I think, especially in my teaching, probably has been around vulnerable child, healthy adult dialogues.
Yeah.
And I guess the example would be, you know, you have a client, you know, you're doing some work with maybe the critic mode, setting some limits or dealing with a demanding critic or something. Mm-hmm. And you turn to the client and they go, how you feel? And they go, well, I need that, you know, it feels weird having that not be there.
Like the critic, you mean?
Yeah, the critic not being there or the coping mode not being there. And I don't think, you know, and this sort of sense of not being able to trust themselves, that kind of concept.
Yeah. So and how would you, I mean, I think that can come up, that lack of self-trust. I think sometimes clients call it self-doubt. They'll use the word self-doubt.
Yeah, and being able to back yourself, trust your own. So turning that concept of self-doubt into a mode concept and you know, I was speaking to one of my supervisees, Dave Cooper, who was talking about this as a thing in OCD, you know, so, you know, fear of future self, this idea. So, you know, what if I turn into a pedophile? What if I kill my children? This sort of stuff that, you know, that would go with that kind of idea of like trusting that you're okay, you can manage whatever comes up. I mean, obviously, that level of OCD is a bit different, but it would fit with what we're talking about trying to get the client to be able to respond to the vulnerabilities and their ability to cope with things and be able to step back and get them to sort of connect with their healthy adult and respond to those sort of
things. So what's your conceptualization in that case? It sort of seems quite vulnerable to me, this sort of, no, like what if this, you know, bad thing happened?
Yeah,
feels a bit vulnerable.
Yeah. So often, you know, you might see, so the way that I've sort of been encouraging people to think about it is like getting dialogues, be the vulnerable child mode, be that vulnerable part of you, feeling anxious, can you say, you know, I can't, I don't know if you can look after me. You know, I don't know if you can sort this out. I don't know if I can deal with these feelings or this event or these experiences.
I mean,
the response to that, the healthy adult, you know, sitting up straight, connecting to the strong, stable, resourced side and being able to get that dialogue going.
Yeah. So I think there's two different things, at least we're talking about, like the way you talked about it in the beginning of this discussion was like, if I don't have that critic, for example, then I wouldn't know what to do. And that's a form of self-doubt, like doubting my ability to regulate, to live, to guide myself.
Yeah.
And then what your second thing you're talking about is more specific to sort of those kind of intrusive thought ideas, OCD.
Not necessarily. I mean, I think it just goes with that. That might be an example, a bigger, more clinically driven example within OCD. But just this idea of being able to tolerate, manage, being able to kind of withstand
doubt. Uncertainty. I guess what we're talking about is uncertainty as well.
Yeah. And those sorts of things. So it's an interesting thing. You know, normally with rather than actually saying, you know, tell Lil you, you got this. You've got this. And using that
guide. And what they usually have though. I mean, this is often involved, is an inner critic kind of force saying you're bad, you're evil, you're a pedophile, spurting sort of negative content at the client, at the vulnerability. So it does sound like there is still, within self-doubt, there's room for some of that, you know, being caught up in the vulnerable child.
Yeah, so I would say there's a vulnerable child feeling all these doubtful, anxious feeling.
Like the doubtful consequences.
Yeah, and then the healthy adult responding to that. And another good example is...
You know, and the critic. This would be the other part.
And the critic,
But,
and normally we would just deal with the critic and go, well, you know, we don't need you giving a negative sentiment or we don't need you to give them, you know, this and that. But there is a bit of kind of... I guess it even goes with the whole just the basic concept of the schema. Like if you have schema change, it feels awkward and weird. It doesn't feel natural. It feels like you're walking in someone else's shoes. So even at that level, being able to reassure at a mode level, you know, it's normal to feel these feelings. I've got it. I'll deal with it. Leave it with me. You know, you'll get easy. You'll eat the broccoli. That kind of idea too. So just something interesting because I don't see it much in the literature and I don't see it in the resources and this sort of stuff. Often we're dealing with all these other coping modes, but we don't get the healthy adult directly.
And I guess too, the message is not just like you've got this, but that even if it doesn't work out, it'll be okay. Like it's okay to fluff your way through or if something bad happens, we'll deal with that when we get to it.
Yeah. It reminds me, you know, a long time ago, I remember speaking to someone and they were sort of saying, we're trying to teach clients to teach them that they can handle their feelings. They can handle their emotions. They can tolerate this. And that goes with that stuff too. I mean, you know, you're trying to overestimate, you know, you're underestimating your ability to cope with a lot of anxiety problems.
So a lot of this feels like in the anxiety disorders kind of realm, doesn't it? Like a bit OCD, GAD, anxiety.
Could be dependent. It could be any, I mean, really, it could be anything. I mean, it could be like, you know, I don't know if this new way of being is right. Well, leave it with me. I'll deal with it. That kind of stuff. So at the pointy end could be,
I had some you know, I was supervising someone recently and the issue came up of, you know, when the clients are looking for reassurance about different things, what to do.
Yeah.
You know, and our role in that you know, with someone who's clearly, you know, feeling vulnerable and doesn't have a high degree of maybe competence to make decisions. And that means they doubt everything that they do.
Yeah.
And our role in that, in letting them know that they, you know, they're on the right track or going through certain decisions with them and saying, you know, that sounds fair enough to me. And it sounds like a fair enough choice. But also straddling this sort of guiding them more directly versus trying to get them to own a choice.
Yeah. So I guess some of this stuff we're talking about is probably more in the second half of the therapy. You know, initially we might be guiding and reassuring, but later on we're like, look, come on, let's get some dialogues with this, you know, with your healthy side and
yeah.
Bounce pass
back to me. All right. That's cool. Well, the first thing on my mind is, you know, we went to Remco's Vendor Vineyard, his workshop. It was a one-day workshop in Bali, and he was talking about different ideas in empathic confrontation. And I guess there's two things related to that I've been sort of thinking about. He was saying that the way that he learned empathic confrontation was actually, through Jeff Young, was confrontation first, followed by, I guess, some repairing empathy. That must be really hard for you, and this is a kind of choice, and this is costing you, but linking to the vulnerability and the empathy.
It's almost like confrontation empathically.
Yeah, confrontating empathy or something. Yeah, yeah. So he was saying that's how he's always kind of done it. And then he's realized over the time, getting access to different trainers, and certainly in particular, he mentioned Wendy Bahari, he's realized that she tends to do it the other way around, where she leads with the empathy. And in fact, when we had Wendy on our pod, we ended up calling her thing empathic confrontation.
Yes, I mean, with a capital E,
right?
The empathy.
So she leads with all the empathy.
Yeah.
I must say that's how we've always done it. I think in terms of like a general approach, it's been like the empathy part, right? And then trying to land some confrontation.
Yeah.
So that was interesting. Like he was kind of thinking that through. And then so what he's come up with is this kind of framework for, you know, that you could do it either way, and then you have to decide, well, why would you do it one way or the other? And what he was sort of saying is that think about your window of tolerance and with a certain client, and that his guide, like the way he's kind of come up, and I think it makes a lot of sense, if the client is very, you know, overly activated, right? So the client's in the room, there's some issue that needs confronting. Whatever. Let's say there's all this really severe avoidance. They're not doing any work or something. But in the room, the client is so activated already. The window of tolerance, you know, is almost, you know, busting through the window of tolerance. He was saying, right, what would you lead with? Do you lead with the more compassionate, empathic part of that? Or do you lead in with a confrontation when someone's already feeling very vulnerable? Right. And so his take was that you can use a window of tolerance to help you decide and formulate what you need to do. The opposite of that, of course, are your clients who are very unactivated, very detached, avoiding, even in the session. They're you know, underwhelmed. There's no affect in the session. And he was saying that he likes that, therefore, to lead more with the confrontation first. Yeah. And he'd say, hey, you know, have you noticed this thing happening between us? You know, what's happening right now? I've noticed this behavior. Yeah. And that, of course, is confronting the client and can put them up into the therapeutic window and get them a little bit more activated, then he's landing the empathic side of the empathic confrontation. So I thought that was really cool. That was a sort of, what did you think?
One thing I thought about that as well is that even in when people are learning how to do empathic confrontation, so the classic thing for empathic confrontation would be, look, I get it. I understand. It's hard. It's really tough coming to see me. But, you know, when you speak to me like that, that hurts me and it affects me. So that's the confrontation bit as opposed to the empathy bit. But I think one thing I do notice with some people, and it probably is a bit of a self-reflection for me when I was starting to learn it, is that you can easily go to the confrontation fairly quickly anyway. Like if you're learning the model, you kind of almost kind of shoot off too hard. Maybe you've got someone that's pretty tough and you're resenting it and you kind of
you get permission from Chris.
Don't talk to me like that.
You know, you kind of shoot it off.
You're level one.
Yeah.
I mean, something I always say now in the level one workshops as a half joke, half truth, is I say, look, guys, this, like you talk about empathic confrontation, say, look, but it is both. Remember that. You have to land it with empathy because what you get sometimes, if you don't warn, you know, supervisees, therapists about that, the classic thing is you get like a bunch, like in level two training, they come back and they go, oh, I've just been doing all this confronting. Yeah. And it's kind of gone a bit haywire.
100%.
So I usually land that little bit of advice now just to make sure it is empathic confrontation. You have to land that with a lot of empathy. The client has to understand that you know where all this comes from.
Yeah.
Like it's not like you're just judging them, you think they're a bad dude or whatever. You understand that this behavior comes from a place, you know.
And it also highlights that you need to know and get a grip on your own gear, because like if you are able to be sturdy and either go with the big E or go with the big C, the empathy or confrontation, and choose what you want to do, then that's different from just reacting and just getting confronting. You know, so if you're strong in yourself, then you can go, oh, I think this person needs a bit more confrontation, rather than just automatically going with that.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally. Yeah. So that's a cool idea. You know, this idea of, you know, using the window of tolerance to tell you which side to lean on first. And then that led actually to a sense. Now, I'd already thought about this before, that landing, particularly experiential interventions, is a fine-tuned process where you're kind of turning dials up and down, you know, particularly for the client. You're trying to fit in the window. You know, you do an imagery. Do you do it with eyes closed? You know, do you do present tense? Do you, you know, all those kind of things, you know, do you start with a safety image versus no safety image, you know, all the kind of little nuances you might do to try to fit in the window.
Yeah.
Do you do an extensive, bit more of an extensive skills-based thing first versus just going straight in there? You know, this is based on a formulation of your client and also what's happening in the moment.
Yeah.
So that, you know, I've always had that awareness, it's kind of dialing up, dialing down. And that's a nice metaphor.
Yeah, nice idea.
Dial up, dial down. What are we doing there?
Yeah.
And this is an example of the dialing up, dialing down, this empathic confrontation issue.
Perfect.
The other thing he was kind of doing that I thought was interesting is he was kind of dialing himself up and down. So he had this awareness that in empathic confrontation, sometimes he gets a bit activated. So he was doing things within himself to keep himself centered. So he'd do things like, for example, if he was feeling a bit like vulnerable, he'd try to sit up straight and he'd say, right, like, so now I'm going to do this empathic confrontation. So he sits up straight to channel his healthy adult. And he's sort of saying also, if he gets a bit activated, like looking at the client's face, he actually looks away and starts talking in general terms about like what he's trying to achieve and what he's noticed. And that's something he found keeps him in a window of tolerance.
Yeah.
When he's trying to land a sort of, I'm imagining more of a confrontation.
Yeah, perfect.
But that was, so he's got his own dials.
Yeah, exactly.
He's turning up and down. Then he's turning up and down some dials on the client, like how am I, you know. So for me, this is also makes me feel good or safe in the sense that I don't think AI would ever be able to replace a therapist because of this. There's this real art to like turning it up.
Yeah, that's very true. I think maybe in that domain, we won't be superseded. Okay, I've got one. Bounce pass, three-pointer, passes to me. Oh, okay, I'm going to slam it up in another idea. Okay, so the excellent ISST conference has just been held in Warsaw, and unfortunately, both Rob and myself and, some other Australians couldn't get there because
Bruce is busy.
The tyranny of distance as well. It's not just, you know, it's a 23-hour flight and it's hard. But to the credit of ISST, the resources are extremely good to watch online. So I've been getting through a bit of that. And it's not so much kind of something new for myself, at least. I work with a lot of trauma and do a lot of EMDR and things like that. But Janice Bredis, who's based in the UK, just had a really lovely presentation focusing on somatic resourcing. So, you know, using physical somatic resources. So resourcing is often used in trauma work and EMDR, often, you know, building up a sense of resource. And I think that's a big thing that's, like I mentioned, you know, before we used to just not really focus on ways to develop the strength and the resources that the person has. in the healthy adult, it's kind of, it was just sort of absorbed somehow and no one really focused on it. But now there is a much more focus on this is elements of the healthy adult. These are, you know, the things that you can do to strengthen that. And Yanis did a great presentation in terms of, you know, somatic ways to resource.
Because some of that resourcing stuff is in the sort of, in our old book with Eckhart, the contextual schema therapy book.
Yeah.
But he's really been integrating this, Yanis has really been integrating these more somatic resourcing.
Yeah. So I've always gone to somatic kind of presentations often and kind of walked out going, yeah, but how do you do it? Like, so his presentation was quite good because it sort of showed you some really, really classic.
Quite practical.
Practical kind of. Yeah. So he talks about a
because otherwise you just get this message that it's in the body.
Yeah, it's all in the body. It's all in the body. Trauma's in the body.
But then it's like, okay, what? How would we change our practice? What would you do? Yeah,
exactly. So there's a little, yeah, some things are just great reminders for myself, just like, you know, in terms of, you know, being, looking at physical posturing and sense, you know, sort of being able to do things like the butterfly hug or particular types of hugs, self-hugs. You know, so it's mainly self-hug. So, you know, ways that you could touch your hands or your body or even tapping your body to get out of a detached state, this sort of stuff. You know, he talks about like, you know, different types of breathing, different types of grounding to the here and now, different types of movement, you know, might be pushing against things to get more sort of empowered kind of feelings. You know, containment, you know, using kind of like imagery. You could use the imagery or use some sort of physical boundary. It's all physical, you know, and I guess it's...
I mean, it's part of that too. Like we never thought of it that way, but when you throw a chair out of the room, that's a part of like expelling some energy, like setting a physical boundary.
Yeah. And usually the therapist is doing that, right? So if you're getting the client to do it.
When you get the client to do it, it's so much more powerful.
It's much more powerful. So it's that kind of, you know, do that again and repeating that motion maybe. Or, you know, in terms of imagery, it's, you know, you could do the imagery as is, but you could also kind of get the client to, you know, rub their tummy and put their arm on their shoulder. Mm-hmm. And that kind of soothing imagery kind of might enhance the maybe the nurturing.
So he's got a lot of ideas about how to, you know, engage the somatic side. I mean, that makes complete sense on the schema model, right, too, because we know that, you know, the three parts of a schema, right? Mm. There's the imagery memory part, there's the feeling slash bodily sensations, and there's the meaning slash cognition.
Yeah.
So it's right there in the model, like the emotion slash bodily sensations. What do we do with those bodily sensations? A lot of the time we just connect to it and say, oh, that's where you're feeling that in the body.
Yeah, exactly.
But how do we work with that to engender some change in the schema?
Yeah. So. And a little, like a couple of little things, like little things in the video, he was like, just something very simple stuff. And it reminded me of, you know, a long time ago that I've forgotten to do it, but, you know, doing things like posturing, just sitting up straight. Imagine that there's like a cord pulling up. A bit like what you were saying to before about
what I saw Remco doing. Yeah he does that a lot. The body posture.
Pulling up straight, just sitting up straight. Just imagine that you're pulling a cord that's attached to your spinal cord or your head, and you're sitting up straight. Just notice how that feels. It's like, yeah, I feel when I do that, I feel more empowered. I know that, you know, Remco does a lot of flamenco dancing, and he's posturing. Yeah, that's a part of the deal. He does that. I think, you know, in the expression, you do feel different when you're posturing. So. Things like that. I thought that was quite neat. So if you've got access to the International Society.
What I've found with these things is usually you pick up these kind of nuances off different trainers, and it's just like little bits of art. Like like Remco's found over the years that if he sits up straight like that, he gets a bit of a better reaction. And someone else, Susan, will do it differently. And you know, different people do it differently.
Yeah, it's a little
thing. Usually we just pick these things up. But it's kind of cool that Yanis is working on that, you know, in some way to categorize it all and give us a bit of a palette, I guess.
Exactly. Oh, yeah, over to you. Yeah, pass.
Over to me, baby. Yeah. Okay.
He's got it.
That's pretty cool. So quick games, good game. Okay. So one of the things that we were looking at while at the conference in Bali was on day two, we had the pleasure of having Georgie Porlik from the Perth Voices Clinic talk to us about her research and practice. Georgie has been, I believe, a real pioneer applying schema-based techniques, things like imagery scripting, chair work, and now full-blown schema therapy to folks that are experiencing psychotic symptoms.
She's a powerhouse. She's a powerhouse.
Yeah.
Yeah. And look, you know, if you haven't met Georgie, she is so much energy and so much intellectual kind of powerhouse in terms of, you know, testing things out, practicing things, open to new experiences.
And she's also an avid listener of What's the Schemata, I learned. So she's one of those ones, I think, or does she do power walk or something, or, you know, and she's listened to the pod. So that was really cool. But, I mean, her topic is so fascinating, her PhD topic that she's turned into a research and practice career. So let me just kind of reflect with you, Chris, and then we can talk together. So what I got out of it, the initial basis for her foray into working with voices, with schema-based techniques, right? Initially, she started by testing what was needed was she realized that most clients with auditory hallucinations, okay, and whom even those that were relatively well managed on medication, that they, if they were suffering from experiences related to voice hearing, that they tended to have childhood trauma, okay? More often than not, fairly close to the surface or fairly easy to link to the voice hearing experience. So she's been conducting a series of studies over the past 5 to 10 years, looking at, can you apply schema-based techniques or trauma processing techniques to voice hearing experiences? And she's shown now in a series of studies, and this is what's fascinating, that it's safe and effective to apply imagery rescripting to voice hearers that also suffer from PTSD symptoms. Okay, in particular targeting, and what she's sort of doing is targeting the voices by targeting childhood memories that are thematically linked to the voice hearing experience. Now.
And it's interesting. It's interesting with this as well, is that, I mean, as a run-of-the-mill clin psych clinician, as soon as you start saying voice hearers, I'm automatically thinking someone with, you know, some sort of psychotic experience, you know, schizophrenia, this sort of stuff. And, she was very helpful for me to kind of make a point that, you know, this is, it's not that, it's it could be psychosis, but there's a lot of other conditions, particularly complex trauma, where you do have, you know, that's a part of the deal, voice hearing, and that kind of, sort of auditory hallucinations and experiences like that.
Yeah. So we're not necessarily talking about schizophrenia, schizoaffective disorder, et cetera. Yeah. Sometimes we are, you know, looking at her research, quite a few of the clients involved in the trial did attract those diagnoses. But she's just sort of looking at it from that single symptom approach and seeing what they can do about the voice hearing experience. And so the first thing, I mean, just to, share what I got out of it is, now, surprise, surprise, a very large portion of those voices are, in her view, a manifestation of what we would call the critic, of an inner disparaging critic that's telling you nasty things about yourself. Okay, so she's been able to work in an imagery rescripting way and reduce certainly the distress and in some cases also the frequency and the veracity of things like voice hearing experiences by targeting the trauma memories that seem to underpin those experiences. Expanding the model, it's not only the critic, but also it could be the vulnerable child mode. It could be different coping modes that become audible.
Yeah.
Right? So it's the idea that coping modes and modes can become so intense that they become audible and experienced as either hallucinations or voices. So what do you think?
Yeah, one thing that I picked up was it's a bit like what I sort of say or I would think about in terms of trauma, particularly the content which is shameful and uncomfortable to talk about, often therapists don't ask. And you have this sort of don't ask, don't tell type thing. And if you have been sexually abused as a child, therapists don't necessarily ask that question. And then 2 years into therapy, they find out that that's there. Mm-hmm. Same thing with this. It's that, you know, it's the same sort of story. If you don't ask, do you have... Yeah. You know, this experience, no one's going to say it.
Not many people are motivated to lead with, I hear voices.
Yeah. And, you know, there's the examples that she was demonstrating that, you know, where that disclosure didn't end up going that well for the particular person because sent them on a, you know, psychosis trajectory when really this person might have just had complex trauma with some audible hallucinations. So
you're going to say audio hallucinations.
Audio hallucinations.
Yeah. Well, so what she would do with the mode map is she'd try to place the voice hearing, and sometimes there are different voices, so that this you could have different modes with different voices. You know, a paranoid over controller would be saying, you know, they're out to get you and, you know, don't trust and, you know, these kind of things. Yeah. There could be sort of helpless surrenderer type voices telling the client to kill themselves, you know, to commit suicide. And the command hallucinations, you could say, could be a part of a coping mode experience. The way she would formulate it, and it's very cool, is she'd have the modes. And then for those modes that sometimes are expressed in an audible way through a voice, she'd have like a little megaphone, like icon on top of the mode circle. And that would remind the client and also the therapist that this there are voices associated with this mode. So that was fascinating. I guess the only other thing I'll quickly mention as a part of this is, and you know that I totally agree with this, in her practice and the way that she addresses these critical voices, akin to it to an inner critic, but or in an audible
like
way.
Super critic, like often.
Super, mega so critic. It's like a megaphone inner, critic.
Yeah, inner critic, yep.
But she absolutely sees them, not always, but almost always, as having some kind of function within the client's personality. And she explores that function at a lot of depth. And she's almost always assuming that she wants to see, you know, if we can uncover that function and bring it to the surface, it's going to almost be always useful for the client to have that awareness that voice plays a role for them. So I just thought that was super interesting, given I think that's one of the debates in the schema field at the moment about the critic. How did you take that?
Yeah, I think with the critic stuff, the more I was thinking about this in the coffee breaks and talking with some other people around this is, you know, when you've got complex trauma and big T, repeated early trauma, I think there's a big factor of helplessness that a kid has when you're being tortured or you're stuck powerless in an environment where you're unable to have a say. And I think this is where the importance of these sorts of self-critical modes can kind of evoke, because it can lead to a sense at the time for a kid to get a sense of control of their environment. If they can restrict their own behavior, then they're less likely to get yelled at. If they can keep it together and not cry, and whether or not that's in a diet of criticism and punishment, that at that time did serve a function. So I think the really key thing is like this helpless kind of
vulnerable.
Yeah, extremely vulnerable.
Like the child is so vulnerable.
Yeah. And there's
I always got this sense from those complex trauma clients where there's a perpetrator and the voice is a perpetrator. Always got it. Look, I say a sense. This is not scientific. Yeah. It's just my observation that the voice would almost the function to protect them from real world punishment. Yeah. That if the voice piped up and said, then they might be able to avoid actually getting punished or actually abused from the abuser, or to decrease the frequency of those experiences if they took on the voice in some ways.
So it's a bit of a, I think the interesting thing with some of this stuff as well is, you know, whether Dave Edwards talks a little bit about this. Professor Dave Edwards is from South Africa. He talks about child coping modes. And I think it's interesting around the idea how a mode can over time possibly change. Like you might have a mode as a 15-year-old or a 5-year-old, and that way of coping could be a coping mode then. But how does that change when they're 25? Is it still a coping mode? Is it turned into more of a critic? But do you deal with that differently? There's a lot of questions, you know. So yeah.
Mate, so that was very inspiring. Yeah. Yeah.
We've had a great little basketball bounce around, idea bounce around for the 2024. Learnings.
Little 2024 geek out.
Yeah.
Freshness. I hope everyone's, well, has been as interested as we are in some of these things. We're always looking for this little edge, little nuance, fresh piece of schema practice. So, yeah, we'll keep bringing you what we can. It's been nice hanging out with you, Chris. We try to do these things about every month. We're about a week late this time, but we'll get back on track. So thanks, everyone, for tuning in and listening. We'll see you guys soon. And guys, don't forget, actually, I have to do a plug, at least one plug on a pod. We have a conference coming up in November of 2024. It's called the Connect Schema Therapy Conference. The conference will be held in Sydney. It's a great opportunity to come together and connect face-to-face if you can get out to Sydney. Of course.
Do you remember the date?
It's early November. I'm pretty sure
Monday the 5th. I think it's Monday.
November. Let me check. I think it's November 4th, but we should be very precise about these things. If you're going to do a plug, it's actually November the 4th. Yeah, I was right. Monday, November 4th. You can come face. It's a low-cost event. Come and hang out with us. Come and talk about schema. We really just wanted to do something to link with the community. We've been doing a lot of things online, of course, since COVID. So we wanted to come back and start doing these conferences again. So we hope to see as many of you there as we can. You can also attend online. So both versions, the online and the live event, you can check it out if you go to schematherapytrainingonline.com. You should be able to click through to the option that says Connect Conference. So I hope to see some of you guys there. Thanks, Chris. Lovely seeing you again.
I come out of my bunker. I feel like coming out of the schema bunker.
Come on,
now.
Mate. You got to get moving. Stop avoiding. Get out there. Okay.
I'll see you guys soon. See you guys.
Take care.
Thanks very much. Bye.